Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Get Better Today with Matt Mayberry. I'm your host. I'm so excited today. We have an extraordinary guest that will be joining us, Liz Elting. She is the CEO and founder of the Elizabeth Elting Foundation. She's a decorated entrepreneur, businesswoman, author of the new book, Dream Big and Win. She's the co-founder of the company Transperfect, a language solutions company. She grew it into a $1 billion company. This idea originated in her dorm room at NYU. Liz Elting has been named to Forbes' richest self-made women list every single year since its inception. Please join me for this wonderful interview with Liz Elting, where we talk everything from leadership, going after your dreams and aspirations in life, how to move past fear and achieve the extraordinary. Please join me for this wonderful interview with Liz Elting. Thank you so much. Liz Elting, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you. How are you doing, Matt?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you so much. Liz, saying that your journey and story is remarkable would be an understatement. Doing a little bit of research and background on your journey, all the adversities that you had to overcome, but most importantly, the significance and all the incredible accomplishments that you've achieved throughout the course of your life have just been phenomenal. But I really want to start with, what is the greatest discovery and your lessons learned throughout your journey? If someone was to say, what are some of the greatest discoveries and lessons learned from your journey, what would that be?
Okay, well, certainly if I look back over the years, one of the things I think I learned, and I think we as leaders tend to learn, is it isn't about you and what you do when you're leading a team of people and shooting for the stars. It's about them and what you can inspire them to do, and about propping them up and motivating them and making it so they want to win with you and they want to deliver with you. And you make it all about them. And, you know, I think that's definitely something I learned. I certainly had no idea about that when I started, because I had virtually no management, no leadership experience. So definitely I learned that. Another thing I learned was, I thought the key to differentiating our business was to spoil the client and spoil the client with service, spoil the client with quality. And I still do. I think the way you do that is by spoiling the employees with motivating them and perks and incentivizing them to want to deliver. And then they do. And then the revenues and the profits follow. So I think it comes back to the people, you know, on both counts.
I love that. I love that. And everybody looks at your, kind of like how I started, you know, your remarkable accomplishments and everything that you've done throughout the course of your life, both personally and professionally. But everybody probably sees your success stories. But where did the journey of Liz Elting begin? Can you talk and share a little bit more about your backstory and really what made you who you are today?
Yeah. And I had a lot of issues growing up. I mean, everything from when I was little, I was painfully shy. I remember my report card I would get, well, she's curious, she loves reading, but painfully shy. So that was something I needed to overcome. And then I have a couple of stories. Like, for example, when I was in my music class, when I was in grade six, we called it grade six in Canada, sixth grade. I was growing up in Toronto at that. I had moved to Toronto at that point. Originally, I lived in Westchester, New York, in Chappaqua. Then I lived in Portugal, where I came out of my shell to a large degree on the painfully shy thing. But then there I was at about 12 years old. I was in my music class, and I do share this. I'll just share this little anecdote, but basically there I was, and I was doing my favorite thing, singing in a group of about 60 students because there were two classes combined. And I was so happy singing one of my favorite songs. It was from the album Joseph and His Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. And the teacher got to me, the music teacher, choral director, and she said, this is it. She stopped. She went listening to everybody as they were saying, walking along the row, listening, stopped at me and said, this is it. And I thought, oh, she's going to call me out for a solo. I'm going to have a solo. She said, this is the problem. You need to go downstairs. And when we have music class every week for the rest of the school year, which was a long time at that point, you need to stay there and just, you can't be in the choir because you're off key. And I don't see that changing. And so I learned from that. I learned a few things. One is I actually learned related to business and life. Don't call people out in public. It's very humiliating. But another thing was I thought, okay, she may humiliate me and I may be so embarrassed, but I'm not going to let that stop me. I am going to get out there and sing when appropriate. And that might not be my ultimate career. I may never be a professional singer, but I'm going to find something I can do and do it better than anyone else and give it everything I have. So that was an interesting lesson learned. And that was character building. And then I talk about in my book, I talk about that, but I also talk about what I went through in 10th grade after being hit by a car and basically went through a horrible injury. Didn't think I was going to make it. Fortunately, after 3 days in a coma, I did make it. But I talk about how that's character building as well, because I went through a very tough time in school with my big cast and my platform shoe, and it was down to 77 pounds, and it was just not a good situation. And I was alone. I was totally alone. And I thought, okay, you know, at least I lived. At least I got through this. At least I dodged a bullet when I didn't die, because I could have died if, like, with the fractured skull. And I thought, okay, I'm meant to be here for something bigger than myself. And so that was character building. But it was a very difficult time in 10th grade because I looked so ridiculous. I had no friends, and it was a terrible, terrible situation. But I got through it, and it made me stronger. So went through a lot of things. I mean, certainly more, but those were some of my real character building experiences. And I think when things like that happen to us, you know, adversity builds character. It builds drive. Absolutely. It builds hunger to do better, to be better, and to not let those things stop us.
Absolutely. And, you know, you spoke of your book, and I have a copy right here, Dream Big and Win, Translating Passion into Purpose and Creating a $1 Billion Business. Why did you get the inspiration to write this book, Liz?
I got it because I loved being an entrepreneur for 26 years, but I really started when I didn't know much. I had virtually no experience managing people. And I was a kid. I was, you know, 26 years old, and I learned over the 26-year period when I owned my company a lot along the way. And I thought I could share what I did right and the many things I did wrong and what I learned from them and what, if I were doing it all again, what I would do differently. So the purpose of this book really was to create something I wished I had had when I was in my 20s, when I was starting my career. And I say it's kind of like a beach read business book. I try to make it very, a very easy read, lots of anecdotes, entertaining, but with the lessons I learned. And I really could have used a book like this 30 years ago. And I thought, it's time. I've sold my company. I'm doing my foundation work. And one of my favorite things to do is talk about entrepreneurship. So why not put it in a book and just get it out there?
Trans Perfect, the company that you built into a $1 billion business, that dream started in a dorm room. Can you talk more about that and how that dream originated?
Sure. Well, so I learned quickly I loved languages. I had studied 4 languages by the time I graduated from high school, majored in languages in college, and then was fortunate enough to get a job at a translation company in 1987, like way back in the day. And I loved the company, loved the industry, but I thought, this is great, but I think it can be done better. I saw gaps between what clients needed and what was available in the industry. I thought there needed to be better service, meaning faster service, more deliverables, an in-person presence, so offices in every major city around the world, and really an end-to-end solution, like all different products related to languages, whatever the client, and services, whatever the clients needed. So I saw this gap. I kept that idea in my head. And then I went to business school, got my MBA from NYU. And without telling the story of what happened after NYU, in a nutshell, I got a job in finance. I quickly learned that company and that industry was not for me. And I thought, I don't like to be a quitter. Quitters never win. Winners never quit. I really don't want to. I just got my MBA, so I've got to use it, but I'm miserable. And so after only 4 weeks at that job, I said to my boss, I'm so sorry. I made a horrible mistake. How much time do you need? And he said, 2 weeks is fine. And I left and I thought, you know what? If not now, when? I was young. I was 26, as I said. I was used to living like a student. I didn't have family commitments. I didn't have financial commitments other than to pay my very low bills because I was living kind of like a pauper, which is what you need to do. It's ideal. And I thought, why not now? And so I started back then when I was 26 out of the NYU Business School dorm room. And that was, you know, why it was my aha moment when I thought, I'll try something else. I'll try something more practical and maybe more lucrative. And then I thought, life is short. And I love the translation industry. And I think we can do this better.
Wow. And what would you say with your experience in entrepreneurship, you know, because there are a lot of people, whether they're listening or watching, where they may have a dream or aspiration of starting their own business, something that's a passion of theirs. And like you said, you went out into the real world and got that experience at a job. How would you say, you know, when is the right time to go after that dream? Obviously, the younger, the better. You know, you can take more calculated risks and so forth. Yeah. But what would you say is a good indicator for when to take the appropriate risk, but also go after that dream or aspiration that you had to start your own business?
Yeah. I mean, for me, you know, as I said, I think it worked well to do it when I was relatively young, 26 years old. I think that is a wonderful time to do it because in order to be successful, you need to put in the time. You need to put in a lot of hours and not quit just because you're busy. You are not busy because you have other commitments or you want to go out for drinks with your friends or you want to go to the beach on the weekend. I mean, you need to really throw yourself into it and go all in. And I think, as I said, it's easier when you're younger, you're giving up less. So I think that's a wonderful time to do it. I think you can always find reasons why the time is not right. You can overanalyze the situation and say, well, it's not a good time because of this or that or this. But again, if you can do it, if you're in a position to do it, do it. And I guess the last thing I'll say is it helps if you have some sort of idea on what to do, of course. I mean, not some sort of idea. You need to know what you're going to do. But I think the important thing there is it doesn't have to be you don't need to invent something entirely new to be wildly successful. Mm-hmm. It's really important to not confuse being an entrepreneur with being an inventor. In the business I was in, we're definitely not inventing something new. There were actually 10,000 other translation companies out there at the time, but they were tiny moms and pops. And I thought the idea would be to build something bigger and better and global. And that was the other companies were started and run by linguists who were busy doing the translations, so they couldn't scale their company. So the important thing is, it doesn't have to be something brand new. It just has to be different in some way and better. And that's, I think, very important. And again, I always talk about how when Steve Jobs had the idea for the iPhone, there were other smartphones out there. There was the BlackBerry. So it was about doing something differently and better.
Absolutely. And can you, I think speaking on that terms, you know, entrepreneurship and going after your dreams and aspirations, can you talk a little bit about the importance of taking risks and what helped you throughout your journey of actually taking action?
Yeah, and it feels so much less like a risk when you take action along with it. When you say, okay, I'm going to do this, but I'm going to nail down what my goals are. You know, what are my goals as far as revenue? Because the reason the revenue is so important is the number one reason companies go out of business is they run out of cash. So you need that revenue. So you nail down your revenue goals. And then you break them down by month and by week and all that. And then you figure out, okay, what actions do I need to take to accomplish those goals? And then you keep revising them every year. And then you keep revising the actions and you make them higher every year and you make sure you deliver. And I think that's very important. It's about actions. That's why each chapter is a verb. It's about actions. I mean, anybody can dream big, but you need to follow through with the action. I mean, doing right. eclipses dreaming. But the other thing I'd say, and I think this is really important to scale a company, is you need to focus on sales from the beginning to the end, because that's how you pay your bills and that's how you scale your company. And it's how you give people raises, perks, et cetera. But what I was going to say is the way we were able to do it is when we hired people, we would say, you need to achieve these certain objectives. And it was like a revenue number, like $50,000 a month for three consecutive months. And then we will hire a second person to help you, you know, work on getting more clients. And the two of you need to sell $120,000 a month for three consecutive months. And we will hire a third and so on. And the point there is, it doesn't feel like such a risk if you're only adding people and adding overhead when you have the corresponding revenue. And it's actually much less of a risk than if you go out and get funding, you get other people's money, and then you're under pressure to deliver, and you may not ever get the revenue you need to make their investment worthwhile. So I'm a big believer in bootstrapping too, and then it feels much less like a risk as well.
Absolutely. But why do you think that a lot of people are scared to take risks or go after, you know, to take that action, to use the verbs? You know, what do you think, and even with your own journey, when you were younger, starting out and building your company from the ground up, what are some of the best practices or things that you did to help get out of your comfort zone and actually go after that dream full steam ahead?
Yeah. I mean, I think that people feel like there are certain things they should do in life. And that was what happened to me. And it's why after business school, I very briefly tried out finance, because I thought, I have my MBA in finance and international business, and this costs a lot of money, and my parents were kind enough to pay for it, so I can't go and do something else. But I did. And if you're in a position where you can do it, do it. So I think they feel like there's something they should do and they have to do. So I think that's one thing. You know, I think another reason is maybe people don't necessarily want to put in the time and the hours and the actions that go along with it. But it really is wonderful and incredibly rewarding, because you hire like-minded people. You work with them, you're all working toward a certain goal, you're solving a problem for a client, and you're learning so much along the way. So it can be incredibly like rewarding and right. pleasurable. And you know, it's only work if you'd rather be doing something else, I guess is the saying. And I think people don't know that, you know, maybe they could actually enjoy it, but they don't want to necessarily commit. But yeah. It's so worth it.
Well, if you don't want to put in the work, entrepreneurship's not for you.
Exactly. As Gary Player says, I always loved his quote, the harder you work, the luckier you get. Exactly. Right. It's all about the work. And that's the silver bullet. And it's not a very exciting sounding one, but that is it, right?
Well, you can never escape it. You can never escape it. You know, even with the technology and AI and these great things that we have at our disposal now, I mean, I think a lot of people look for the shortcuts, but I mean, at the end of the day, if you're not willing to invest and put in the work up front, maybe it's just not for you.
Oh, yes. And that's why I say, work today like no one else will, so you can live and give tomorrow like no one else can. But it's work. But again, work doesn't have to be the opposite of happiness. And a lot of us love it. We love the thrill of victory, you know, the things that go along with the hard work.
Right.
Yes.
And that's why I love, I mean, one of the reasons why I love not only your book, but I mean, also the title, you know, because it's not a book where it's just telling you to dream big and, you know, hey, you'll achieve your dreams, or, you know, like the secret, like positive thinking and success is just going to come to you automatically. Speaking on this term of taking risks, you know, I think that end part of your title, dream big and win. And in order to win, you have to take massive action. Every day you have to take massive action on the highly prioritized items that are going to inch you closer to getting to that BHAG. Can you yes. talk a little bit about what really has helped you throughout your journey to not just dream big, but win? Like how did you yes. get started and get going and taking yes. action even when you didn't feel like it?
Yes. And I love what you're saying about the title, but because you appreciate winning. And I think one of your books had winning in the title,
yep.
right? Or win.
Yep. Winning yes. Plays, my first book. Yep.
Yes. There you go. I love that. Wait, is it there? Oh, no. Okay, it's not there. But I love that because, yes, it's fun and exciting to win. And yes, but okay, so back to what it takes. I talk about in the book what we needed to do to accomplish our goals. And the first goal was, the first is establishing goals. And the goal was to get out of that dorm room within 6 months and have a real office. Because back then, having an office and a prestigious address mattered more than it does now. I mean, now so many people are working remotely. It's a different story. But back then, it was critical to becoming a global company. So the goal was 6 months. So then the thought was, okay, what do we need to do? And in our case, it was make 300 phone calls in a day to figure out who at a company to send our marketing material to and then send out 300 letters. Now, the calls could still be a part of it, but it could be emails, it could be LinkedIn connections, making a certain number a day. But I think it's all about giving yourself a goal that you need to accomplish in a day and then in a week and a month to get to the revenue number, which in our case was to get us out of the office. I mean, out of the dorm room into the office, sorry. But so it was all about 300 phone calls a day, 300 letters. And, you know, what could happen is I think it might have taken 500 or 1,000 letters to get one project. Maybe it was 500 letters to get a call back. And then right. 1,000 to get one project. And people think, well, I can't do that. But you just do it. You just throw yourself in and do it. And the reason that's okay is even if it takes 1,000 letters to get one small project, I mean, in business today and in business back then, that one small project, and I remember one of our earliest projects that got us out of the dorm room, can turn into multiple projects, and the multiple projects can turn into a relationship. And that's why it might seem, okay, I just made 1,000 phone calls and sent out 1,000 letters to get $100 project, but that can lead through being a test and then more projects from that same client or from other clients that they will refer you to multiple projects and multi-million dollar relationships. But back to what you said, it's all about the intensity and the volume and committing to it. And I talk about in my book, I would make myself make 50 phone calls or 100 phone calls before getting up and getting a cup of coffee. And then, you know, send out 100 letters before having lunch or whatever it was. And just being really tough on yourself. And it's a means to an end, and it works. It works. I mean, it's, you know, hard work. It's, I guess I call it focus. I say focus, pocus, because you focus, you're intense, you work hard, and then it's like magic, right?
Absolutely.
It's not, but it's not magic because it's hard work.
Right.
But that hard work really does lead to results. And the other thing that I talk about in the book is acting like when you're an entrepreneur, like you have a boss. And I remember doing that and thinking, okay, if I had a boss, what would I have to present to them? And I thought, okay, I'm going to show them that we're going to open 4 offices this year, 1 per quarter. And I remember putting on paper, and these were our first offices outside of New York. I remember San Francisco, Atlanta, Washington, D.C., Chicago, but in that order, 1 a quarter. And that sounds actually daunting, but it's not, because you start with one person. Back then for us, it was in an executive suite. Now it might be from home. They need to accomplish certain goals, and then you add a person. And that's how you build these offices. But being tough on yourself, being tough on yourself, that I think is super important, because a lot of people think, oh, I want to be an entrepreneur and then I can do what I want with my time. Sure, you can be your boss, but you have to be a tough boss. I think that's really the point.
And I mean, at least in my experience, I mean, I think being your own boss, at least in the very beginning, like you actually end up working more. You work longer and harder than, you know, having a 9-to-5 or working for somebody else. That's why you do have to love it. But I love it, Liz. And I really think everything you're talking about, you know, one of the things I talked about, and we obviously talked here before we got on, is the importance of behaviors, you know, and really taking behaviors and having them be at scale. Because hearing you talk about the title of Dream Big and Win, you didn't spend that much time talking about the dreams or goals that you had. You talked about the actions and behaviors that you had to do. And I think so many people, they want to focus on the dream and aspiration too much without looking at the actual key result they need to do every day, day in and day out.
That's right. And that's the key to accomplishing the goal And then you accomplish it at the end of the year, and then you make new goals to get to the next level. But absolutely, it's all about the actions. And it sounds quite simple, but people who are willing to do that, to put in the time, who have the discipline, who are tough on themselves, those are the people who make it. Yeah.
Yep. And how would you, once you did start it to scale, you know, back in those early days, you know, how did you take that really and make it company-wide? You know, obviously, I'm sure every individual and leader had their own individual goals, but how did you really start to scale that and drive, you know, accountability around that?
Yes. Oh, well, everybody did have their own goals. But one of the things that we required both of ourselves and everybody around us is we had an end of day report. And in the end of day report, everybody would have to write the number of letters or phone calls they made, the number of letters they sent out, the number of good connections they made, the possible jobs in the pipeline, and then the number of jobs they closed, like literally data, like our KPIs were in everybody's end of day report. And they just got used to doing that. That was part of our culture. And so they needed to send them to their boss. And, you know, so that was one thing. We also were required everybody to have goals. Everybody had their own goals based on their history and their results. And then we were very public about results. And we put the people, the managers would email, like the overall sales manager, if we're focused on sales, would show everybody on in the entire sales team's results, like right there in front of everyone. And we had them up on walls. We were very transparent. And the same thing on the production side. I mean, I'm talking about sales now, but production was key to this as well, because so many of the sales came not from new business development, but as I was saying earlier, you get a client, you spoil them with quality and service, and then that first project turns into multiple projects. The multiple projects turns into a long-term relationship and repeat business and referrals. So the production people, their results were also very public. I mean, we shared them, and we made it all about results. That was one of the core values, results. I mean, it sounds so obvious, but I mean, looking at showing results every day and every week and every month and making them public, I think that was very valuable as well.
And it's a very subtle but respectful way to maybe not call out low performers, but you're setting a standard. You're setting a standard where you're not publicly calling out an individual or attacking a person. You're attacking the problem.
Yes, you know? Exactly. You got it. No, and that's the thing. When you're giving feedback, it's all about the problem or the behavior. I mean, unless it's great, and then you shout it from the hills. But yes, if it's negative feedback, of course, then you make it more about the behaviors. But yes, so the people who were at the top loved it when it was public, and we didn't focus in on the people who were at the bottom. But those things ended up working themselves out over time. So yeah, that was very valuable. So the culture was very much about results and sharing them. And goals, very much about goals. I talk a lot about goals in the book, you know, daily, weekly, monthly, annual, etc. But I think you have to, and I think they need to be very clear to both. You need to make them clear to yourself and the team. You need to make them public, because then you're more likely to deliver on them. And I think that is absolutely critical. And I think, as you were saying earlier, Matt, people talk about dreams. I've definitely seen a lot of people talk about dreams. But it's like, yes, but goals and then the actions to accomplish those goals. That's really the key.
Right. And I think, I mean, one of the things, Liz, that really frustrates me working with a lot of organizations, primarily even medium to large size organizations, is leaders not being transparent with the goals, whether it's from an organizational company-wide goal, BHAG for that year, or even sharing transparently with, you know, other leadership team members. Why do you think that is? It sounds very simplistic, but you'd be dumbfounded at how many organizations still don't understand its importance.
Yeah, I don't understand it. I really, really don't. And why is it? I think they think they're protecting someone, but it's not good for anyone, because everybody deserves to be successful and happy, and the two usually go together. So I think, you know, each individual, and you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is the importance of one-on-one meetings with the people who report to you. And that's where you can talk about your goals for them and their goals as far as, you know, professionally. And then you can nail down quantitative goals and what they need to do to accomplish their objectives. And then you go through them each time. But often when people leave a job, it's because their goals aren't, they're not, they don't know what their goals are. They don't know how to get to the next level. They don't know how to make more money. They don't know how they're going to get what they want because they weren't shared. So I think certainly they need to be clear between the boss and the employee. And then as far as sharing them across the board, I really don't know why, because people want transparency. They want to know what's going on. You're not protecting anyone not to let them know. I mean, if you want the A team, if you want to keep the top performers, they're going to appreciate it. And those are the ones who are going to stay. And, you know, I talk also in the book about that, how compensating people, you compensate people in such a way that if people are really selling, they're making more than they would anywhere else. And if they're not, of course, they're making less. And a lot of companies don't quite do it that way. And I mean, with I talk about a draw, the draw, making the draw as low as someone is willing to take, but with a high upside. And then, of course, if they're not selling, they're not doing well. But if they're doing well, they're making that high upside and more money than they would make elsewhere. And they're feeling good. And the rest takes care of itself.
But that's, I mean, that's another excuse I hear, though. You mentioned the importance of one-on-one. I can't tell you how many times throughout a given week a people manager or executive leader is saying, I don't have time for one-on-ones. 15, 20 minutes, I just don't have time. We have too much stuff going on, too many complexities we're dealing with. And, you know, you just, it's to me, one of the, I'm just dumbfounded over and over and over again when a leader says that. Because, I mean, like you said, the expectation, the transparency, it's not even about hitting the goal. It's just really understanding and being able to put your head on the pillow at night, knowing if you're doing a good job and you know, if you know what's expected of you.
Yes.
And so
yes.
many workers, they don't know the answers to those questions.
That's right. It's so important. Yes, they don't know what's expected. And so you as a leader want to share what's expected. And then you want to know, are they happy? Are they happy personally? And if they're not, you want to address that and be helpful on that. And then are they happy with their career? Are they getting what they want as far as the opportunity? And so it's mutual. It's beneficial to both because it reduces turnover. And of course, turnover is the worst thing as long as, you know, I mean, it's the worst thing in any case. And certainly it's terrible if you would have wanted to keep the person. And I give a story about how I had someone sitting right outside my office for a long period of time, like right near me for an extended period of time. And one day they came in and they said, I quit. And I thought, wait, how did I not see that coming? What did I do wrong? And it was after that I realized I need to have weekly meetings with these people to not just have work, because I was interacting with that person. We had work going back and forth between us, but we weren't talking about these issues. Like, these are my expectations. These are mine. Are yours being met? Are mine being met? And we make sure everybody is on the same page. So yes, absolutely.
I love it. And Liz, what would you say has been a superpower of yours to create more opportunities and breakthroughs, both in your personal and professional life? Is there anything that comes to mind?
Well, I think, you know, and I say that I'm definitely not the smartest person in the room. I'm not the best at anything. I don't have any special talents as far as tech-wise, as far as sales-wise, as far as public speaking, as far as anything. I think my superpower is just, I'll put in the time, you know, I won't quit. It's the grit. It's the being all in and figuring out, okay, what do I need to do? And I'm going to keep doing it until I've accomplished my objective. I'm not going to quit. I'm going to stay with it, all in, focus. And I think that can be very valuable because that I think is key, just staying with it. You know, during the tough times, I think that's really important. And that's what I've got, because I said, I don't have any special talents at all. And I do think I was fortunate because I hired smart people who were smarter than I was, you know, as they say, hire people smarter than yourself, hire people who are more talented, whose skills complement yours. And so I think I was able to find some amazing people. And I think that's very valuable, of course, but then it's about not quitting.
Yeah, I would say grit is a skill, though. I would say the stick-to-itiveness and the ability to have the consistency of effort over the long haul, that is a skill. I mean, I think that most people, they may be the smartest in the room, but if you don't have that mentality that you're going to have and have the consistency of effort over the long haul, you know, there's going to be an adversity that breaks you. And, you're never going to beat someone like yourself that's just willing to get up every day and just go at it every day, regardless of how you feel or your emotions. You're going to go after it.
No, you're right. And I, in my book, I give Warren Buffett's quote that it's something like the difference between average people and extremely successful is successful people is simply discipline. It's something like that, to that effect. But it's all about, the grit, the working hard, the not quitting. And I do talk about, I like to say, there are a lot of people who are incredibly talented in some way or geniuses, but they're not willing to do what you're saying. They're not willing to put in the effort, the hours, and they get distracted and they move on to the next thing. Sometimes they have too many ideas at one time. They're like, oh, I'm thinking about doing this. And then a week later, oh, but what about this? Or third week, what about this? And it's like, okay, find one and go all in and don't quit. And I think that is so, so critical.
And it's been my experience, even people with very high IQ levels where they're so smart, their intellect is just through the roof. So they're already thinking, five steps, 10 steps ahead of all the challenges they're going to interfere and, run into. So they talk themselves out of going after that dream or whatever that may be.
Yes. And I think a lot of us can be that way. We're too, either because we're too smart. I mean, or too much of a perfectionist, and we overanalyze and we think we need to know everything about, will this work? What's the market? What exactly is there? But instead, just you don't, I mean, I think for a short period of time, be intense and do all the research you can for a short period of time, but then don't wait any longer. Time is the enemy. Just do it, and I think that is absolutely critical. Yes.
I love it. I love it. How do you personally, we've talked a lot about dreams and goals and how having dreams and goals isn't enough. You know, it's a starting point, but it's not enough, right? It's all about the actions and behaviors. But how do you personally, even to this day and with your foundation, with really everything you do, but also in your personal life, how do you personally set goals now, Liz?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, that is, I think, back then it was pretty simple because with my company, I had one big goal and I thought, okay, I'm not going to do it alone. So I need the sales team and I need that. Yeah, all of that. And I need to be able to scale it. Then I realized what was missing I realized what, how fortunate I was and all the problems in the world. And I thought, okay, I'm going to focus on trying to make the world better, but that's not a very specific goal, right? So with that, I've thought, okay, I need to come up with very specific causes that I'm involved in. I mean, I'm involved, I have a mission for my foundation, and I've gotten involved in a number of causes. But the next step is to really narrow it and figure out, okay, what is the specific impact I want to make on each area? I mean, then I did the book. I did have goals as far as the book that is coming out. But I'm not answering your question. I'm so sorry.
No, you're fine.
No. I mean, I think I find now it's easier to come up with goals like, okay, I'm going to make sure I walk 5 miles a day. the daily goals of things that need to happen. I think at this stage of my life, after first the company and the foundation and now the book, at this point, I measure what I'm doing by, okay, is it helping other people? Because I was very fortunate. I was one of the lucky ones. And now I really want to give back. It's the least I can do. And am I enjoying it? That's just sort of how I'm measuring what I do. But I did have goals for my book. I had numerical goals. I had qualitative goals. But I think we need to keep redefining our goals and then doing what we need to do to achieve them. But that's a great question.
What is the piece of advice that you would give to somebody looking to live a bigger, more fulfilled life, that they want to go after bigger goals and dreams and actually take the action? Was that at the end of the year, getting down and just setting 5 goals for yourself? What is a practical thing that has worked for you in your life?
Well, certainly with my business, it was every year, okay, I wanted revenue to be higher and profit to be higher. It was very simple. That's the nice thing about business. It's very quantifiable.
Keep it simple.
From a numbers perspective. Yes. And I need things that are simple. But no, I mean, really, I think I always felt that way, that I wanted to make sure in things I could measure that they were going up. And, you know, they say, I mean, I know I have all my quotes, but I do love quotes, even though I think it's about actions instead, ultimately. But if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. So, okay. So measurable things, great. Measurable things, great. I think, so I have advice that people should always try to do a little more than they did the year before, as far as things that you can measure. And then people need to keep reassessing what's important to them in each phase of their life. I mean, that's kind of obvious, but yeah. It's kind of true. No, but I think the most important thing, I guess, is if you don't know what you're shooting for, then how are you really going to accomplish anything? So it's just really clearly reassessing your goals on a regular basis, annually or more often, and then taking the actions to achieve them. And I know that sounds quite basic and obvious, but, you know, with business, it's not always what people do. And right, that's what we've been talking about in this conversation. So yeah, it's just continually assessing, okay, but what do I want now? And then making sure you take the actions to get there, and being bold and not thinking it's not the time. Go for it. Worst comes to worst. It doesn't work out. You learn from it. You meet some nice people or some interesting people, some good connections, and you move on to the next thing.
I love it. I love it. Liz, what one of the things that you talk about is really creating an environment where people feel comfortable to disagree. And one of the things, a big part of my work and what I do is obviously, you know, working with leaders and different leadership teams. When I think right now more than ever, you know, psychological safety, being able to cultivate a culture where people in a respectful way can disagree. What is something that has worked for you as a leader? You know, in the very beginning stages, but obviously that probably looked a little bit different once you scaled and went to the next level. But what is a practical thing that all leaders, whether a small business owner, entrepreneur, they're a CEO of a, you know, 10,000 employee organization, what is something that has worked for you to be able to cultivate a psychological safe culture?
Right. Well, my favorite question, first of all, I love meeting with employees, you know, coworkers. I love that, and sharing and getting their ideas. And I talked to you about the one-on-one meetings. Love those. I also am a big believer in employee questionnaires, you know, employee surveys, exit interviews, all of that. And in all of these, whether it's in a conversation with an employee, whether it's in a survey, whether it's in an exit interview, my favorite question is always, what would you do differently if you owned the company or ran the company? And it's basically soliciting input for sure, but even disagreement, you know, something that's contrary to what you're doing. So it's asking for it. Tell me something I should be doing differently to do a better job. And I think by asking that question orally, by asking it in writing, that's a great way to let people know you don't want yes people. You need ideas. You need ideas on how to be better. And so that is critical to me. It was definitely critical to me as a leader. My favorite question, as I said, and then having things like innovation contests or requiring someone to have an idea or an innovation in order to be promoted, you know, for certain positions, I implemented that. And that was critical. And I think all of those things show we don't want you to just go along with how things are. We want you to suggest your ideas and how things can improve. And so I think those are some of the ways that I encourage that.
Through your journey, your own leadership journey, but also with your foundation work and everything that you've done, you've obviously come across exceptional leaders in even different industries. What are maybe the top two qualities of exceptional leaders that without a doubt, there's right off the top of your tongue, you're able to say these are regardless of what industry they're in or what they do, right? These are the top two exceptional qualities of the most phenomenal leaders I've ever met.
Yeah. Well, I think they tend to be incredibly curious. They always want to know more about everything, anything, everything, how things work, how things are, whatever, in the industry, how things are in the world, because that's how they can come up with ideas. And they do come up with ideas, and it makes them think outside the box. So I think that insanely curious, I think that's very important. I think another thing is incredibly proactive. And that can be a, you know, that can follow from being curious, but incredibly proactive, anticipating people's needs or before they know they have them, but not being waiting to be told anything, just doing it. So proactivity, definitely inspiring others to follow the dream, to evangelize their vision. So yeah, I mean, but basically to inspire others to build the dream. Working hard, being very, I know you asked for two, being very can do, just being positive, figuring out ways to do things, not how not to do them, not talking about why they can't be done, just going in there, finding ways to do them and getting them done. Sorry, I know you only asked for two, so I'll stop talking.
No, those are fantastic. I mean, your first one is, the best coaches I had in sports and in the game of football, but also the exceptional business leaders I've met throughout the past 13 years, particularly, being radically curious always, always, always stands out and is number one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it boggles my mind. I mean, because when you hear the conversation of the difference between managers and leaders, a lot of people managers will think, I've arrived. I'm here. I know it all. Don't tell me what to do. I'm great. Everything's perfect. And then you'll notice, though, in a different organization where the CEO of a 200,000 person organization is out in the front lines, asking questions, actively listening and roaming the halls. And you start to see the difference there. So I love you saying number one is curiosity, because I think so many people underestimate the true power in displaying curiosity in really everything that you do, but particularly in leadership.
Totally agree. Totally agree.
And can you talk about, before we close here, more about the Elizabeth Elting Foundation? What is really at the core of that mission? Because I know that one of the things you're passionate about is helping women entrepreneurs continually advance and succeed.
Yeah.
Can you talk more about that?
Yes, absolutely. And I love helping women entrepreneurs succeed. Absolutely. And I love helping support women in business or people who are from marginalized communities or people who haven't had the same opportunities and chances that I've had. And so I do it in a number of ways. And I guess I'm involved in something called NYU Business School's Endless Frontier Labs. It's the best accelerator program out there. It doesn't actually relate to being an NYU student. The entrepreneurs are entrepreneurs ages 25 to 75 all over the globe. And they are in three different tracks, digital tech, deep tech, and life sciences. And they're people who have these amazing ideas, often to make the world a better place, like early markers of cancer, ideas for identifying or treating Alzheimer's. I mean, all kinds of things. But I'm involved in that program, and at the end of the year, each year, we award to, and now we have other people who've joined on to it, the leading women-run companies investments. So that's one thing. Another is the American Heart Association Social Impact Fund, and we invest in these social entrepreneurs in marginalized communities. Also very involved in education and funding education for people who haven't had the opportunity to have it paid for, and doing that in a number of different places. You know, I always say entrepreneurship and education are two great equalizers. And so I think those are very important. I will say, and that's when you asked me about my goals, I realized, okay, I need to make sure I focus a little better, because I have gotten involved in a number of other things like cancer, like heart disease, like gun safety, like hunger. And the reason so many is, I think, you know, what happens is we're out there and we're meeting people and we're learning about more issues and more problems, and we're meeting people who have been directly affected. And then we think, okay, I'll do what I can. So that's the kind of work I'm doing with my foundation right now. And it's really been so incredibly gratifying, because I'm one of the lucky ones. My timing was good. I met amazing people. We built something, and now, you know, it's my time to give back. So it's been very, very exciting, and I'm getting so much out of it, and I'm learning so much, and I love the learning.
Thank you so much for sharing that. To wrap up here, Liz, and I am going to put you on the spot here. What is a goal that you want to achieve, whether that's in a year from now, 5 years from now? What is one goal that you are going to immerse into and continually work towards every single day, just like you've built your company from the ground up into a $1 billion business? What is a goal that you're incredibly passionate about in the future?
Yeah. Well, I feel like my kind of abstract goal, you know, it's not as concrete as I'd like, it is to make the world a better place. And I know that sounds so corny, and I know a lot of people are working on that, but I think, you know, the more people we have working on it, the closer we're going to get to that. But again, it's not maybe as concrete as you want to hear right now. I mean, the other is, I want to make a difference in as many people's lives as I can, whether it's making it so they can be successful entrepreneurs, so they can have wonderful careers, so they can live long, healthy lives. And then, you know, the nice thing about that is they will then, you know, if they can have a positive impact on other people and other people's lives, then the advantages just are amazing, because you affect a number of people, and they affect a few, and they affect a few, and so on. But I'm just trying to make the world a better place and the situation better for as many people as I can.
Liz, thank you so much for your time. Everybody, please go get a copy of Dream Big and Win. It is out now. It's already been a bestseller, correct? You hit the bestseller list. Massive success with that already. I read the book. It's a phenomenal book. We actually share the same publisher, so I've had the great privilege of having a behind the scenes look at the amount of work that went into this book. So please, Dream Big and Win. I'll put the links and information in the description, and you will do yourself a great favor by picking up a copy of that. Liz, thank you so much. Continue your excellence. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you so much. Congrats to you.
Thank you.